Good evening, brethren and sisters, and welcome to our Bible class this evening. Our brother Brian will continue our consideration of Isaiah chapter 10 this evening under the theme, The Remnant Shall Return.
Thanks, brother Philip, and my dear brethren and sisters and young people. I suppose when we were all young, we thought that one time there would be an opportunity when we would manage every passage of the scripture. Has that ever occurred to you that when you were young you read many passages and you thought, I wonder what that really means? And you set yourself a goal that eventually you'd really find out what that passage means. There's lots of areas of the scripture, aren't there, that are not easy going, and you can do the readings year by year and think to yourself, I'd love to know what the meaning of that chapter is. Isaiah 10 is one of those, isn't it? It's not an easy chapter. As Jason was reading that, just in one straight through run like that, I thought, my word, aren't there an amazing number of figures of speech? Now, who's speaking here and about whom? And what's that figure of speech mean? And so there's a tremendous amount involved in Isaiah chapter 10. So it is really a chapter of tremendous interest to us, something we can get our teeth into, and we can go away from the end of this night, hopefully, and say, well, I certainly understand the basic concepts of that chapter. That's what Bible class is all about, isn't it? Bible class is a really good class in our ecclesial program, understanding the Word. Now, for the sins of Israel, which had been enunciated in a fourfold refrain, which the fourth of those refrains was in chapter 10, verse 1 to 4, for that God had prepared the Assyrian. But the Assyrian was not there to run riot. O Assyrian, verse 5, the rod of mine anger, and the staff in whose hand is my indignation. In other words, he was there to employ, he was employed for God's anger, to exercise God's indignation. I will send him against a hypocritical nation, indeed. And against the people of my wrath will I give him a charge. To take the spoil and to take the prey and to tread them down like the mire of the streets. Yes, Israel was not the nation that it should have been, though it was called of God's name. There was the hypocrite and the evildoer of chapter 9 and verse 17. The nation as a whole was very much a hypocritical nation. Do you remember chapter 1? And all of those ordinances of the temple that were reiterated there. Point after point, chapter 1 explains as part of the practices of the children of Judah. To what purpose is the multitude of your sacrifices unto me? Verse 11 in chapter 1, saith Yahweh. I'm full of the burnt offerings of rams and the fat of fed beasts. Very, very much were the ordinations of the law being kept up. But it was of no pleasure to God. Bring no more vain oblation, verse 13. Incense is an abomination. Your new moons, verse 14, and your appointed feasts, my soul hateth. I'm weary to bear them. When you spread forth your hands, God says, I will close mine ears. It was indeed a hypocritical nation with much religion, but their heart was far from him. And so Assyria had a charge. There was a divine program written down for Assyria to accomplish. But Assyria, like Babylon would after her, once she was unleashed, went rampart against the children of Judah and relished the cause for which God had brought her. Howbeit, so says God in verse 7, he meaneth not so. That is to say, Assyria has not got this straight. He doesn't understand that I have a charge upon him. He thinks he does it in his own strength. Neither does his heart think so. What's Assyria's turn of mind? Well, not certainly a messenger on behalf of Yahweh of hosts of Israel. No, but it is in his heart to destroy and cut off nations, not a few. He thinks that he would just go on and do as he likes. Now, I don't think we referred last time. We didn't actually turn up Habakkuk chapter 1, but I think we did actually mention it. Is that correct? But it's so analogous that I just thought we ought to have a look at it. Habakkuk chapter 1. This is a reference to the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, who would also come down upon Judah, but at a later time, of course, than Assyria. We know it's the Chaldeans because chapter 1 verse 6 says so. For lo, I raise up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, which shall march through the breadth of the land to possess the dwelling places that are not theirs. They're dreadful, terrible and dreadful. Their judgment and their dignity shall proceed of themselves. So they'll be caught up with their own sense of power, of authority over the nations. And when Habakkuk saw that, he really thought that God had made a mistake. He said in verse 12, "Art thou not from everlasting, O Yahweh, my God? Mine Holy One, we shall not die. Judah's not the nation that should perish. O Yahweh, thou hast ordained them for judgment." That is to say, the Gentile nations. "And O mighty God, thou hast established them for correction." If they should have a role, it might be for correction. "Your judgment, your correction should be upon them. Thou art of purer eyes and to behold evil, and canst not look on iniquity. Wherefore lookest thou upon them that deal treacherously, and holdest thy tongue when the wicked devour the man that is more righteous than he?" How can you bring wicked, the Chaldea, upon, well, not a good Judah, but not as wicked as Chaldea? It doesn't seem a right balance, says the man, the prophet Habakkuk. "And makest men," verse 14, "as the fishes of the sea, as the creeping things that have no ruler over them. They take up all of them with the angle or the hook. They catch them in their net and gather them in their drag. Therefore they rejoice and are glad." The figure there is of a fisherman who, having taken one lovely fish from the sea, he doesn't stop, does he? He doesn't say, "Well, there's enough here for tonight's tea, a few more, enough here for the week. I'll leave that at that," does he? The excitement of the fisherman is such that he just keeps on throwing and throwing in until he would take the whole lot, either with his net or with his angle or his hook, verse 15. "Therefore they sacrifice unto their net and burn incense unto their drag, because by them their portion is fat and their meat plenteous." That is to say, they worship their achievement. See the sense of that? "Shall they therefore empty their net and not spare continually to slay the nations?" Can you see Habakkuk's fear? He said, "You let them go and they'll never finish. And they'll come through Judah and there won't be a vestige left. Every fish of Israel, as it were, will be taken in their net and in their hook, and they will take the lot with them till there's nothing left." Now that's exactly the same picture that you've got back here in Isaiah chapter 10. In verse 7, describing the Assyrian attitude, it's exactly what Habakkuk saw of the Chaldean, that bitter and hasty nation, terrible and dreadful. It's exactly the same idea. And you see, that's exactly what did happen, isn't it? It happened with the Chaldeans. Remember that quote, that beautiful quote in Zechariah chapter 1 and verse 15, and we did turn that one up last time, where it says, "I was a little displeased with the heathen, but thou hast helped forward the affliction." Remember that quote? And so God looked down and there was the Chaldean, not just coming to do what God had told him he must do, but taking absolute relish in it and destroying the children of Jacob and going beyond what God really wanted him to do. Well, that would be the same with the Chaldean before him. And God knew that. And in the subsequent verses, he describes the sense of pride and accomplishment. "For he saith, are not my princes altogether kings? Even my juniors have been given dominion over such large territory." They had been made deputies over different territories, like a king does, a great king. "Until even his princes that he's appointed over different areas, they're like kings reigning in their own right." You might remember, for example, the case of Napoleon, who began appointing his brothers and others to different kingdoms, didn't he? His brother became king of Italy, Napoleon's brother, just for a little period of time. But that's the concept, you see, when a kingdom becomes very powerful. "Aren't my princes altogether kings? Is not Calno as Carchemish? And we remember Carchemish. There's one reference to Carchemish in the 2nd of Chronicles, chapter 35. The virtue of this is that it gives us some idea of where this place was. 35 and verse 20. After all this, when Josiah had prepared the temple, Necho, king of Egypt, came up to fight against Carchemish by Euphrates, and Josiah went out against him. Carchemish by Euphrates. You remember where Haran was, where Abraham came on his way into the land, sort of halfway. He came up the Euphrates, and so it's in the upper reaches of the river Euphrates. Carchemish is very close to Haran. And Pharaoh Necho was coming up from Egypt, and his intention was to meet the new and great king, the abounding king of Babylon. And he was going to meet him at Carchemish. And Carchemish would be the place, the site of that great battle. One of the great battles of history was fought at Carchemish. So Carchemish, one would therefore understand, was a great city. Is not Calno, which is one of the cities of Assyria, is not that as Carchemish? In Amos chapter 6 there's a reference to Calno. You wouldn't expect references to many Assyrian cities, would you? So if some of their cities are mentioned, then they would be great cities, wouldn't they? Amos chapter 6 and verse 1. Woe to them that are at ease in Zion and trust in the mountain of Samaria, which are named chief of the nations to whom the house of Israel came. Pass ye unto Calneh, that's our city, and see. And from thence go ye to Hamath the Great. Then go down to Gath of the Philistines. Be they better than these kingdoms, or their border greater than your border? Ye that put far away the evil day and cause the seat of violence to come near. And the point of the prophet's message was, those places were greater than your cities, but they've suffered judgment. Do you think by the ease that you illustrate your evil, the sophistication, your casual attitude to the things of God, do you think that you're going to survive when those other kingdoms have not? That's the point. So the sense of that is that Calneh therefore was a great city. Is not Calneh as Carchemish? Is not Hamath as Arpad, is the next question. Now they were two Syrian cities. If we turn to the 2nd of Kings 18 verse 34, the sense of that is gathered. The 2nd of Kings 18 and 34, the boastful Rabshakeh, who was the captain of the guard, or the captain of Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, he said this in 2 Kings 18 verse 34, and he's saying this to the people on the walls. He's saying, take verse 33 to give the sense. Hath any of the gods of the nations delivered at all his land out of the hand of the king of Assyria? Why do you even make a resistance? Have any others been able to resist? Where are the gods of Hamath and of Arpad? There's our two cities. Where are the gods of Sepharvaim, Hena, and Ivah? Have they delivered Samaria out of mine hand? Who are they among all the gods of the country that have delivered their country out of mine hand, that Yahweh should deliver Jerusalem out of my hand? In the 49th chapter of Jeremiah, very quickly, again, there's not many references to these places, so it's just as well to gather these into our margin, isn't it? Make our Bibles talk a little later. Jeremiah 49 and verse 23. Concerning Damascus, Hamath is confounded, and Arpad. For they have heard evil tidings. They are faint-hearted. There is sorrow on the sea. It cannot be quiet. So again, Hamath and Arpad are put together. they were two Syrian cities, as also, of course, was Damascus in verse 23. And both of them suffered an assault from Assyria and were taken by the great king Assyria. That's very clear, isn't it, from the king's reference that they had been taken. Is not Hamath as Arpad? In other words, both in my hand together. And then it says, is not Samaria as Damascus? Well, again, both of those cities had also been taken. One Jewish, or rather Israelitish, and the other Gentile. But they had both been taken over by the king of Assyria. And when he took over Samaria, which was the capital of the northern kingdom, of course, when he did that, Sennacherib placed the last king that that kingdom had, whose name was Hoshea, the last king of the northern kingdom, Hoshea, he made him as a puppet king over that northern people. So although there was just a period of a few years, I think he reigned for, was it 6 or was it 11 years, Hoshea, yet he did so as a puppet of the great king of Assyria. So is not Samaria as Damascus? Was not Hamath and Arpad taken? Was not also Damascus? And is not your capital in the north, Samaria, the same as the other Gentile Assyrian or Syrian peoples, Syrian cities? As thy hand hath found, verse 10, the kingdoms of the idols, and whose graven images did excel them of Jerusalem of Samaria, shall I not, as I have done unto Samaria and her idols, so do to Jerusalem and her idols. And so, as the prophet puts forth the mind of Assyria, these are not the actual words of Assyria, are they? They're the prophet describing, by God's hand, the mind of Assyria. He goes from kings far away, draws closer to Syria, then to the northern kingdom, and thus places his argument against Jerusalem itself, getting closer to them all the time. We notice that he says, as my hand hath found the kingdoms of the idols. It's interesting, isn't it? You see, it was really recognised that Israel and Judah were different. But then Samaria or Israel did have her idols. But then Judah was different again from Samaria. So she was not the kingdom of idols. And she was not a city given over to graven images by history. She, among the nations, was known to be different to that. But you see that it says there, and whose graven images did excel them of Jerusalem and of Samaria. Now if you turn, tragically, to the 2 Kings 16... you'll find that very foolishly it would seem that their idols did excel, because in the 2 Kings 16, as we have looked it up several times, verse 10, King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet the Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and saw an altar that was Damascus, and King Ahaz sent to Urijah the priest the fashion of the altar and the pattern of it according to all the workmanship thereof. And that altar then became built, didn't it, in Jerusalem. Verse 17, King Ahaz cut off the borders of the bases, removed the labour from off them, and took down the sea from off the brazen oxen that were under it, and put it upon a pavement of stones, and the covert for the Sabbath that they had built in the house, and the king's entry without turned he from the house of Yahweh for the king of Assyria. So he looked to the kings of those nations more than he looked, or rather the gods of those nations, more than he did to Yahweh, the Holy One of Israel. The Second of Chronicles 28. That classic statement of his perversion. In Second of Chronicles 28 and verse 22, in the time of his distress, Ahaz's, did he trespass yet more against Yahweh? This is that King Ahaz, incorrigible Ahaz, for he sacrificed unto the gods of Damascus, which smote him, And he said, because the gods of the kings of Syria helped them, therefore will I sacrifice to them that they may help me. But they were the ruin of him and of all Israel. And so Assyria mocks Ahaz in the words of, as Isaiah is describing his mind, he says that the graven images of those kingdoms did excel them of Jerusalem and of Samaria. You see, even Jerusalem was not standing, was it? Not staying upon its true source of power, but was trying to copy the foolish nations in their idolatry. And when they did that, their gods indeed became inferior to the gods of the nations, as their own king evidenced. Shall I not, as I have done unto Samaria and her idols, so do to Jerusalem and her idols? It's very salutary, my dear brothers and sisters, to have a look at the historical record and remember that these words are said well before the Sennacherib came down. 2 Chronicles 32. Shall I not, as I have done unto Samaria and her idols, so do to Jerusalem and her idols? How remarkable the words of Isaiah in that 10th chapter. When we look at the actual words that were stated by Rabshakeh when Sennacherib, his king, came down over Judah. 2 Chronicles 32 and verse 11. Doth not Hezekiah persuade you to give over yourselves to die by famine and by thirst, saying, Yahweh our God shall deliver us out of the hand of the king of Assyria? What a wonderful king he was. He was going around that city. He was seeing the people. He was encouraging them by these words. Worry not, he said, about the king of Assyria. Concentrate in your prayers unto Yahweh our God. So much had he said that the message was known even to the enemy without. And so the words of verse 11, quoting the king's words. And this is what Sennacherib said. Hath not the same Hezekiah taken away his high places and his altars, and commanded Judah and Jerusalem, saying, ye shall worship before one altar and burn incense upon it? Hezekiah's tried to concentrate all power in Jerusalem. You did at one time have your own gods. You haven't even got them to look to now, says Sennacherib. Hezekiah has selfishly concentrated all worship to his own capital city. Know ye not what I and my fathers have done unto all the people of other lands? Were the gods of the nations of those lands anyways able to deliver their lands out of mine hand? It's almost a paraphrase of Isaiah chapter 10, isn't it? And remember that Isaiah 10 is coming years ahead of the words of Rabshakeh, or rather of Sennacherib at this time. Who was there among all the gods of those nations, verse 14, that my fathers utterly destroyed, that could deliver his people out of mine hand, that your God should be able to deliver you out of mine hand? Now therefore let not Hezekiah deceive you, nor persuade you on this manner, neither yet believe him. For no God, no Eloah, mighty one, of any nation or kingdom, was able to deliver his people out of mine hand, and out of the hand of my fathers. How much less shall your God deliver you out of mine hand? And his servant spake yet more against Yahweh Elohim and against his servant Hezekiah. Aren't they magnificent words? And you know, if he did recognize Yahweh, it was only in the sense of 2 Kings 18. Got these two records all the time. It makes it a little difficult, doesn't it? But notice the inference here in the 2 Kings 18. The truth was that he probably had heard that Isaiah had said that Assyria was being used by Yahweh, because the people would say, well, look, if Yahweh is to be trusted, then what's Assyria here for? Look, it's on our walls. And Isaiah had said, yes, he is on our walls, but God is using him. What? He's brought him down all through this land. He came first to the north, and now he's now upon us. And you still say that it's really Yahweh in control. Terrific test, isn't it? You imagine if you're inside that city and you had your little children there. And it wasn't a great massive city with tens of square miles, was it? It was really a relatively small area. You were huddled within that. And outside there's 186,000 very hungry Assyrians bent on destroying that city. A fame for destruction that was worldwide. And you're in the midst of that city. And your king was saying, Yahweh our God will deliver us because he has said so. That was the acid test, wasn't it, faith? In the 2 Kings 18 and verse 25, Assyria turns that around and says, am I now come up without Yahweh against this place to destroy it? Yahweh said to me, go up against this land and destroy it. And he was right, wasn't he? Isaiah had said that in his earlier chapter, that there will be a great consumption upon the land of Israel. That fourfold refrain of chapter 9 and first part of chapter 10. And it seems, doesn't it, that he had got to know even that. So if he recognised Yahweh, the God of Israel, it was only to say, he has told me to go up. I'm here by his blessing. And of course, there was a truth in that. Well, should we open the gates? And trust that if this one then has come at God's bidding, he may perhaps spare us. You've got your children there. Why? Sit in the city and die? Or perhaps with some policy we might succeed and live? It's like the Jewish people going to the ghetto, wasn't it? To Auschwitz. They wondered in whom they could trust. In Isaiah chapter 10, now in verse 12. We have in verses 12 to 19 God's judgment to come upon arrogant Assyria. He's paraphrased his words in verses 7 to 11. That's the mind of the king of Assyria. And now in verses 12 to 19, God speaks of his judgment. Yes, he has brought Assyria down, but what will be the end of that story? Wherefore, it shall come to pass that when the Lord hath performed his whole work upon Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, I will punish the fruit of the stout heart of the king of Assyria and the glory of his high looks. So there it is, expressed in a very clear statement. He is coming down, he will do his work, and when it's completed, my whole work upon Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, then judgment will fall upon him because of his pride, his stout heart, and his high looks. In fact, the language there reminds us very much of chapter 2, doesn't it? Verse 11 and 12. Just quickly back to chapter 2. High looks. The lofty looks of man shall be humbled. Haughtiness of men shall be bowed down, and Yahweh alone shall be exalted in that day. For the day of Yahweh of hosts shall be brought upon every one that is proud and lofty, and upon every one that is lifted up, and he shall be brought low, whether he be Judah, Israel, Syria, or Assyria. Upon every one will God bring his judgment that is lifted up. What was the whole work then, do you imagine, in verse 12, that God wished to perform upon Mount Zion and on Jerusalem? Remember that the Assyrian didn't really come into the city, did he? So it wasn't a work of judgment upon Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, was it? It seems, therefore, that the sense of the whole work is that this great crisis in their lives would bring them to such a critical point in need of salvation that it would turn the hearts of those people who were left. It's like us, isn't it? Sometimes we need punishment to pull us back to what we really need to be doing and thinking upon. And in this way, God is bringing this tremendous pressure upon that city. And my dear brothers and sisters, can you imagine how many times those little families must have prayed within that city? How they must have rued all the time wasted. How they must have bemoaned the fact that they had perhaps in earlier times gone to some place of idol worship. Or they got along partly with the foolish King Ahaz's idolatry. and all those other things that they must have been tempted with. But as the pressure was coming upon that city, those people would have purified their hearts, wouldn't they, before him? As they began to cling on to the faith of the great king that was in their city. Not yet, Hezekiah hasn't come yet. But that's what it's going to do. It's Ahaz's day, and it's a day of wickedness. Day of exceeding wickedness. Well, by the pressure coming upon that city, it was going to purify the hearts of those people and draw them to the only source of salvation. And I'm sure that is therefore what it means when the Lord hath performed his whole work upon Mount Zion and on Jerusalem. The remnant would be purified by the process of trial. Happy with that? Verse 13. Well, just before we go there, it says, I will punish the fruit of the stout heart of the king of Assyria. Now, the stout heart is his strength of mind, isn't it? His high looks, is his sense of pride and achievement. So his fruit of the first phrase is equivalent to his glory of the second phrase. In other words, all the abundance of prosperity and ascension, pride and glory and majesty that had come to that kingdom. So God says, I'll punish the very fruits of all of his gains. That which is his glory and his majesty and honour, upon that will I bring my punishment. Isn't that beautiful? Put the thoughts of that verse 12 together. They're extremely beautiful, aren't they? Inside the city of Jerusalem, there's a group of people who should know better. They've had the gospel of salvation. They're going to have to coalesce around the faith of that king until the king and the people are one mind and put their trust upon God. See? And yet outside of that, there is another people whose pride is lifting up. And whilst he's bringing this result upon them, which is a matter of salvation, upon the other, he'll just cut it to shreds and reduce them to naught. You know, it's the exact picture, isn't it, of the world we're living in. There's a remnant that he wishes to save. And in the pressure of circumstances, my dear brothers, to live in the latter days, men's hearts failing them for fear, for looking after those things which are coming upon the earth. In the latter days, we have those pressures coming upon us. And the great powers of the world have been putting their money to armaments and to pride and to glory, to mighty achievements, to great names in the earth. God will cut them down. But what he's really wanting is a work of salvation, performing a whole work of salvation in his ecclesia, to draw them unto himself in the latter days. So there are beautiful analogies in these things. So verse 13 says, for he saith, and again now it's paraphrasing the words of Sennacherib. I mean, Sennacherib's not there yet. There's another king in Assyria in the days of Ahaz, Tiglath-Pileser. But the amazing thing is that these are almost the very words he will say, as we saw those other words were. And that's one of the fascinations of this chapter. And you know, it must have been a tremendously wonderful thing when the people were standing upon the wall, and 10 years before, or was it more than that, 10 or 15 years before, they had heard Isaiah say these things in the streets of Jerusalem, and now they heard them coming from the king of Assyria, or from his spokesman, Rabshakeh. Must have been a tremendously wonderful thing to hear him saying that. Remember, that's exactly what Isaiah said to us. And therefore, if Isaiah was able to paraphrase those words before, he had the answers, didn't he? He knew exactly the hearts of the king of Assyria and what he would say, what his arguments would be. Who would you listen to then? You'd listen to the man who on God's behalf had told you what was the end of the story. Well, for he saith, by the strength of my hand I have done it, and by my wisdom, for I am prudent. You know, that's the swelling arrogance, isn't it? Of a power that has run over a kingdom upon kingdom and seems never to be prevented, like the great river Euphrates that's described as in chapter 8 verse 8 that just bounds over all other lands. And I have removed the bounds of the people and have robbed their treasures, and I have put down the inhabitants like a valiant man, city upon city, kingdom upon kingdom. He'd just run over their borders, come to their cities, taken their cities, gone to their treasuries, removed all of their majesty and taken it with him and gone, slaying their valiant men as he went. Terrible thing, wasn't it, to have a nation on the rampage. Now, there's a lovely passage to put with that one. It's in Deuteronomy chapter 32. Was it given to him to determine the bounds of the kingdoms? Do you remember the beautiful expression in the Song of Moses, when the Most High, Deuteronomy 32 and verse 8, when the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the bounds of the people, there's the phrase, according to the number of the children of Israel. Isn't that beautiful? In other words, God is coming to apportion the world to the nations, you see? And he says, now how shall I carve this land up? Well, Israel, how many people have you got? Such and such number. All right, you will have the first place. Here it is. There's an abundant, beautiful land flowing with milk and honey. You will have that. It's sufficient for you. Now, other nations, all right, you can have this and you can have that. But the best part, the glory of all lands, was given to Israel. That's what Deuteronomy 32 verse 8 is saying. The nations had what was left. Look at the arrogance of the king of Assyria. He says, I am just running over the bounds and I am determining for myself where my limits shall be and where the limits of other kingdoms shall be. You know, it's a fascinating thing to look at history in the light of that. Just by the way, it was the king of Assyria who first took up the policy of transferring peoples. Just make a little reference there. It's 2 Kings 17 verse 6. But it says that when Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, conquered the northern peoples, that he took them into, perhaps we'll have a look at the reference, he took them into the cities of Assyria and of Babylon. 2 Kings 17 verse 6. In the ninth year of Hoshea, that's how many years he reigned, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away into Assyria and placed them in Halah and in Habor by the river of Gozan and in the cities of the Medes. See, what right did he have to pick up hold of a people and take them to another place? Well, it was the king of Assyria that first introduced that policy to a victorious empire. And so they just thought they could cut up the land as they like. You know, people have done that, haven't they? A great deal of that has gone on. I don't know if you've read the Times of Napoleon, but one of the intriguing things of Napoleon is that he no sooner was successful in a battle than it might have been at Jena up at the northern end of Austria there, and there's a great battle. And the battle's only just over, and the kingdom of Austria is in his hands. The Habsburg dominion is now in this once exile's hands. And within a flash, he just portioned off all of the different parts of that country to different princes and dukes and so forth. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. And you can imagine the arrogant fellow that he was. You can imagine him as he was going to that battle. In his mind, he was thinking that when I've taken this, I'll apportion this to this and that to that. And that person that's been good to me, they will have this. And those who have been difficult, they will lose their lands and so on. You know, that's what's happened over the years. Napoleon was rampaging, wasn't he, through Europe. God gave Europe into his hands, Catholic Europe. And as he went, he enjoyed just the same spirit as what we have here in verse 13 of chapter 10. And look at the next figure. This is a terribly interesting chapter, isn't it? It says, and my hand. Did you notice that's the second reference, isn't it? It goes back to 10 verse 5. The staff in mine, in their hand, is mine indignation. But as far as Assyria is concerned, he had a hand to do what he liked. He had independence and he would do what he liked, unrestrained. Again in verse 12, God says, it is my whole work. When the Lord hath performed his whole work with his hand, and Assyria as but the rod, the instrument for that. But you see in verse 13, Assyria says, by the strength of my hand. Again in verse 14, and my hand hath found as a nest the riches of the people. And the riches of the people was referred to in verse 13. They would, of course, always deplete the wealth and riches in the treasuries of the kings and great people when they conquered. But then, having said that, it says this: "And as one gathereth eggs that are left, have I gathered all the earth, and there was none that moved the wing or opened the mouth or peeped." Have you ever gone collecting birds' eggs when you were lads or girls? Did you ever go collecting birds' eggs? There are some birds that will really be very ruffled if you do, and they'll try and protect the eggs of their young, right? But there are others that, as soon as you come near the tree, seem to shoot up into the distance, and it just leaves the nest so vulnerable that you can just come up and take the eggs. And as it says here, there was none that moved the wing or opened the mouth or peeped. No opposition whatsoever. In such a way, by such a graphic figure, Assyria sees himself just going through the nations, and it was just as though the mother bird just flew up into the distance. There was no resistance, and I just came up and I just took them away, like as you gather a few eggs and go on your way. No resistance whatsoever. What an assumption of pride involved in a figure like that. And so the record of Scripture is tremendously interesting. You know, he's applying that, of course, to what he's going to do to Judah, isn't he? There is a beautiful contrast with that. Matthew 23. We all know it very well. But it's lovely to come into this passage now in the light of that and just see what a beautiful passage it is, and ask yourself the question, did not the Lord have this in mind? Matthew 23:37. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stonest them which are sent unto thee, how oft would I have gathered thy children together. Gathered thy children together. He was gathering young ones, wasn't he? Eggs. Even as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings, and ye would not. There he was with a disposition to put them under his wings, and there they would truly be safe, wouldn't they? And he would defend them from Roman, from Russian, from death itself, if only they would come under his wings and seek protection. Look at the disposition of caring. He's not going to fly off into the distance, is he, at the first scent of danger. He will stay and defend them as a hen does her chickens. You know, have you ever seen a hen look after her chickens? We used to keep bantam's eggs when we were young. Bantams, I mean, not just bantam's eggs. But one of the things I vividly remember is the ferocity of a bantam hen. If she's got her eggs and she's sitting upon those eggs, if you come near her, she will go for you. She might leave her eggs behind her, and she will go for you, ferociously attack you. And she's just a little fellow like this, not even the size, half the size of a chook, really. And yet she's prepared to take you on like that. There's a real strong motherly instinct in a hen. And it's a very beautiful figure. And you might just note that where it says chickens, that's a very kindred word in the Greek to the word nest in verse 14 of Isaiah 10 in the Septuagint, where the Septuagint being a Greek text of the Old Testament, where it translates that word nest, it's the word nosia. And that's a very similar word to the word chickens. They're obviously related, chickens and nest. And so the passages have got, you know, some very wonderful agreements in sense. Very beautiful. Look at the contrast in attitudes. I think the Lord, as he said those words, must have had such a passage in mind. He would defend them from Rome if only they would turn to him. And you know, that would have been true, wouldn't it? If they had have turned to him, he would have defended them from Rome. History would have been different if they had but tucked themselves under the protective wings of the Son of God. Well, verse 15. In four figures, God expresses this sense again that Assyria is but the instrument in his hand. Shall the axe boast itself against him that heweth therewith? Do you ever see a man working with an axe and all of a sudden the axe stands up and talks to the man who was using it and tells him what he's going to do? You don't see that, do you? And then he says, or shall the saw magnify itself against him that shaketh it? In other words, that's exercising it. The man is sawing with the saw and he's going back and forth. You don't see the saw suddenly stand up and tell the hewer what to do, do you? He's using these figures to show that Assyria is but the tool or instrument or rod of his indignation. Chapter 10, verse 5. The next one he says is, as if the rod should shake itself against them that lift it up, or as if the staff should lift up itself, as if it were no wood. Wood doesn't act of itself, it's picked up and used. And so in this very grand way, God absolutely makes mockery of the arrogance of Assyria. You can contrast the sense of verse 15 with the sense and arrogance of verse 14 and 13. Could you find a sharper contrast of figures? You know, all through this book, this sense has been given. Turn back quickly to chapter 7. Do you remember that in verse 18, God says there, and it shall come to pass in that day that Yahweh shall hiss for the fly that is in the uttermost part of the rivers of Egypt, and for the bee that is in the land of Assyria. See, he's hissing to the bee from Assyria, saying, come on, I want you to come, it's your turn now. Hooks, hooks in his jaws and draws him down. Actually uses that figure in Chronicles. Hooks in his jaws. Chapter 7 and verse 20. He speaks of him as a razor that is hired. He's going to give him wages. He'll give him benefits for what he will do. But he nevertheless is an instrument in the hand of Yahweh of hosts of Israel. And who do you think is involved where it says in verse 15, as if the rod should shake itself against them that lift it up? Who's the them? It's the angels, isn't it? In the second application, outside of the figure, it's the angels, isn't it? Yahweh and his hosts were bringing this about. Now should Assyria, that the angels have worked into this position, should Assyria now turn against the angels who were operating him and question them? Verse 16, terrible judgment upon Assyria. Verses 16 to 19, terrible judgment upon Assyria. Therefore shall the Lord of hosts, that introduces, doesn't it, the more militant aspect of God, doesn't always, but certainly many times it does. And here's one. Yahweh of hosts, hosts of angels, bent on a sense of punishing purpose. He shall send among his fat ones, that's among Assyria's fat ones, that's among his great ones, those that are embellished in all of the pride and royal majesty that's come to that kingdom. He shall send among the fat ones leanness. Echo, isn't there, of what happened in Egypt, where there were fat cows and there were lean cows, and the lean cows devoured the seven fat cows. Well, so God can bring a kingdom down, can't he, as he did for the kingdom of Egypt at that time. And then it says, and under his glory, that is under the Assyrian's glory, and that glory then is the glory that was mentioned in verse 12, the glory of his high looks. All right, he shall, under his glory, he shall kindle a burning like the burning of a fire. So there is all of his wealth and possessions that he has stripped from all the different temples and cities that he has conquered. And it's all there together. And as you're looking, behold, there is a very red glow developing. And as one looks further, it's like the burning of a fire. All that that was brought together is now going to be consumed. And who lights this fire? Verse 17. And the light of Israel shall be for a fire. There's the fire. Fire, verse 16. It's the light of Israel. A beautiful thing. Assyria's being demolished. It's being burnt down. And who's the fire underneath the glory of Assyria? It's the light of Israel. And his Holy One is for a flame. That's the sense of it. In other words, Israel's Holy One is there igniting that fire that will consume that great pile of Assyrian glory that she has taken from other countries. It will go up in smoke. And then it says at the end of verse 17, and it shall burn and devour his thorns and his briars in one day. There must surely be a little echo of that, of those words, coming through from the 2 Samuel, chapter 23. You know, this is much to do with the house of Israel, isn't it? With the house of David and the Davidic throne. We shall see again that element's coming through. Certainly when the Assyrian came up and God spoke to Hezekiah those beautiful words of confirmation, he says, "For I will defend this city for David's sake." The promise made to David was always there in the background. In 2 Samuel 23, David's last words, he said this, verse 6, "But the sons of Belial shall be all of them as thorns thrust away, because they cannot be taken with hands. But the man that shall touch them must be fenced with iron and the staff of a spear, and they shall be utterly burned with fire in the same place." He will pluck up the thorns and briars and he will consume them with fire. So you've got those figures of speech coming together with interesting correlation here in Isaiah 10. At the end of verse 17, it said that this consumption would be in one day. That's interesting, isn't it? In one day. And it was. If you turn to the 37th chapter, which describes the destruction of Assyria, you will remember that it was, in fact, in one day, wasn't it? In Isaiah 37 and verse 30. "And this shall be a sign unto thee, ye shall eat this year such as groweth of itself, and the second year that which springeth of the same, and in the third year sow ye and reap and plant vineyards and eat the fruit thereof." It would come very quickly, and it did. Verse 36. "Then the angel of Yahweh went forth and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And when they arose early in the morning, behold, they were all dead corpses. The whole lot in one night were gone. Because I will defend this city to save it for mine own sake and for my servant David's sake," verse 35. So you can see, can't you, the sense that's coming into those words there. All that God spoke to David in the past has not been forgotten. Now, I'd like just to come back to the 2 Kings 19. Got three historical records, really, haven't we? The King's record, the Chronicles record, and those middle sections of Isaiah. That's a bit of a challenge, isn't it? To sort of feel that you've mastered the three records. In the 2 Kings 19, verse 22, we read, "Whom hast..." Well, verse 21, "This is the word that Yahweh hath spoken." These are the most beautiful words that came from Isaiah to encourage the heart of King Hezekiah. They are beautiful words. "This is the word that Yahweh hath spoken concerning him: the virgin, the daughter of Zion, hath despised thee and laughed thee to scorn. The daughter of Jerusalem hath shaken her head at thee. Whom hast thou reproached and blasphemed? And against whom hast thou exalted thy voice and lifted up thine eyes on high? Even against the Holy One of Israel." And so it's the Holy One of Israel that is seen as a flame at the bottom of the pile of her glory and of her majesty. You know, in the 37th chapter, again, sorry, 30th chapter, we have this sense of God as a consuming fire presented again. Again, it's in the same context of thought. Isaiah chapter 30, verse 27. "Behold, the name of Yahweh cometh from far, burning with his anger, and the burden thereof is heavy. His lips are full of indignation, and his tongue is a devouring fire, and his breath is an overflowing stream, shall reach to the midst of the neck, to sift the nations with a sieve of vanity, and there shall be a bridle in the jaws of the people, causing them to err. And verse 30 and 31, Yahweh shall cause his glorious voice to be heard, and shall show the lightning down of his arm, with the indignation of his anger, and with the flame of a devouring fire, with scattering and tempest and hailstones. For through the voice of Yahweh shall the Assyrian be beaten down, which smote with a rod. And do you remember how we mentioned last time that in some of the bas reliefs, the king of Assyria is seen there with his truncheon, his rod, you see, beat down with a rod. That's how he liked to see himself. And God says that he's going to beat him down. And he will do that by these various figures of speech. Well, not by the figures of speech, but by these means. He thus describes that achievement. Now, again, in verse 18, the scene of the figure is changed. Makes it a tremendously interesting record, doesn't it? This is very interesting indeed. And shall consume the glory of his forest. So the fire is going now into the glory of his forest and of his fruitful field, both soul and body, and they shall be as when a standard bearer fainteth. You see, a standard bearer is there to rally the troops, isn't it? When the standard bearer is in trouble, then the troops indeed will flee. Right? So that's the sense. They shall be as when a standard bearer fainteth. The rest of the nations would be in great consternation because the one who was really holding the game together was suddenly taken. But isn't it intriguing that Assyria in verse 18 is now described as a forest and as a fruitful field? Fruitful field is a place of many trees, fruit trees. There were various stages of fertility in Israel's lands. There was the wilderness of Judea and other wildernesses, the Shephelah, which was better than that by a long chalk. Then there was the fruitful field, and then there was Lebanon. The forest. You know, Lebanon is often spoken of in that symbolic way, not always referring to the area of Lebanon, but to the ultimate sense of majesty and prosperity and glory. So by those different figures of speech, different categories of people were described. Well, Assyria now, having ascended so greatly, was like a vast forest and a fruitful field, see? Such was the fruit and the glory of their high looks. Now, in the 31st of Ezekiel, we have that taken up again. We're going to have a look at this more next week. But just to open the subject now, Ezekiel 31, verse 8 and 9. In this 31st of Ezekiel, a lesson is given to Pharaoh because of, by means of the destruction of Assyria. In other words, God says to a Pharaoh, he says, now look, what happened to Assyria? Assyria got all the same symptoms that you've got. She had all the same lifting up of herself. But what happened to her? Learn your lesson, Egypt, because that's going to happen to you. Now that's the sense of it. Ezekiel 31, verse 8. The cedars in the garden of God could not hide him. This is describing, you see, how Assyria thought of himself and how the nations thought of him. The cedars in the garden of God. Were there ever better cedars in the Garden of Eden? Oh, no, no, indeed, there wouldn't have been. Well, the cedars in the garden of God could not hide him. Such was the lofty assumption of Assyria, that the greatest trees could never obliterate his glory. That's the sense of it. The fir trees were not like his boughs, and the chestnut trees were not like his branches. Nor any tree in the garden of God was like unto him in beauty. I have made him fair by the multitude of his branches, so that all the trees of Eden that were in the garden of God envied him. Therefore, thus saith the Lord God, because thou hast lifted up thyself in thy height, and he hath shot up his top among the thick boughs, and his heart is lifted up in his height, I have therefore delivered him into the hand of the mighty one of the heathen, who is the Chaldeans, because they destroyed Assyria. He shall surely deal with him. I have driven him out for his wickedness. And strangers, the terrible of the nations, have cut him off and have left him. Upon the mountains and in all the valleys his branches have fallen and his boughs are broken by all the rivers of the land. And all the people of the earth have gone down from his shadow and have left him. And you see, it became a source of great consternation to the world when the standard bearer was fallen. Verse 16, I made the nations to shake at the sound of his fall when I cast him down to hell with them that descend. And so the nations shook with fear and trembling that such a great thing had happened. The standard bearer had fallen. He was, as a standard bearer, fainting. So Ezekiel takes up all of that side, and we shall see that that's very relevant when we come to the rest of the chapter in the near future. Verse 19, such would be the demolishing of this forest, that verse 19 says, the rest of the trees of his forest shall be few, that a child may write them. Like the bushfires that went through those southeast pine plantations. Did you go past in the period after, you just see a tree here left and a little group over there left. You know, it says like as if a little child could come and could count them. A little child that might be able to count to 5 or to 10 or to 20. A great forest of many trees, but that's all that's left. A little child could count. One hand, as it were. He could count the glory that was left. Now verse 20, just to touch upon what the theme was. It shall come to pass in that day that the remnant, the Shear, S-H-E-A-R, the remnant of Israel, and such as are escaped of the house of Jacob. It is said by some that some of those that were taken into the northern lands by Assyria actually escaped from those lands and came back and were found inside the city of Jerusalem in the day of Hezekiah's salvation. Now, if that's true, I'm anxious to have the detail on that, but it is said that that is the case. And those two little phrases may well cater for both. See the sense of that? That the remnant of Israel and such as are escaped of the house of Jacob shall no more again stay or rest, put their security upon him that smote them, like Ahaz did, remember, when he looked to Assyria, and Assyria kept on coming, and all he did was never help him, but in fact harmed him greatly. They shall no more stay upon him that smote him. 2 Kings 16, verse 7 to 10. 2 Chronicles 28, verse 16. 20 to 21 and 23 is your historical reference to that. But rather, they shall stay upon Yahweh, the Holy One of Israel, in truth. The remnant, Shear again, shall return. Even the remnant of Jacob, unto the Ael Gibor, as it is in the Hebrew. The Ael God Gibor, mighty. Usually used in the sense of the great warrior. And to use that in the context of Assyria had a very real pertinence, didn't it? Because Assyria was seen as the great warrior among the nations. Now, if we come back to Isaiah chapter 8. This sense of returning, where are they returning? They're returning unto God. Had they gone away? Well, not physically necessarily. But those who did come into that city, and God's name was upon that city, and the king was with Yahweh, and the prophet was with Yahweh, those who did come into that city from surrounding territory as Assyria was coming down over that land, they indeed did stay upon the mighty God, didn't they? And upon the Holy One of Israel in truth. They drew near to him and stayed in that city when everyone else had gone off. And in chapter 8, that was just what God wanted. In verse 10 it said, take counsel together and it shall come to naught. Speak the word and it shall not stand. For God is with us. In this city is what we need. God is in the city. Emmanuel, God with us. For Yahweh spake thus to me with a strong hand and instructed me that I should not walk in the way of this people, saying, say ye not a confederacy to all them to whom this people shall say a confederacy. The way up was not to make political alliances with other peoples. Neither fear ye their fear, nor be afraid. They will not stay upon him who smote them. but rather, verse 13 of chapter 8, sanctify Yahweh of hosts himself, and let him be your fear, and let him be your dread. And so this remnant would return. They wouldn't physically go anywhere. In fact, they'd be right in that city, but they would be with God. Remember the little phrase in chapter 10 and verse 4, without me they shall bow down under the prisoners, and they shall fall under the slain. But with me, in the city, listening to Isaiah, taking the words of the king to heart, they would return unto their God, and they would fill their heart with consolation in his greatness and his warrior characteristics. That Yahweh of hosts would be over that city with his angels, protecting and defending, casting his wings over that city, that he might be able to defend it from the terrible persecution that was outside. But it would only be a remnant. And that's impressed again in verse 22. For though thy people Israel be as the sand of the sea, yet a remnant of them shall return. So we have four references, haven't we, in that verse to a remnant. And do you remember that that was the name of the first son that Isaiah had? Shear Jasher, a remnant shall return. So, my dear brothers and sisters, we see the way that God has worked. Now, we don't like to think of it like this, do we? That a remnant of the ecclesia will be saved, because we're a pretty small remnant now, aren't we? We're a very small people in a very large world. But nevertheless, there are parables that say that there were five wise and five foolish. It's a terrible thing to contemplate, isn't it? There'll be five wise and five foolish. Five that have truly returned unto the mighty God of Jacob, and have opened their heart to him, and their prayers are toward him, and their minds are there, and they're prepared to work and to give their lives in his cause, settling around him in Zion, in the ecclesia, looking to all the things that need to be done here. Let's make sure that if that's the case, we're in the remnant, then the Lord will save.